Welcome back to How to Tickle Yourself. I'm your host, Duff McDonald. My co-host, Joey of Rockledge, will be joining me in the second half of this show. In every episode of this podcast, we and our guests try to seek out and grab hold of the tickle of our true selves. By sharing stories about the great things in life, we hope to point the way to the goal of all goals, the source of infinite bliss, the supreme reality itself. Maybe we'll find it someday. In the meantime, we hope, at the very least, to inform and entertain with conversations that hover at ratings approaching 100%. At How to Tickle Yourself, we follow our tickle wherever it leads. All of which brings me to today's guest, Eric Hirschberg. Hirschberg is what you might call a Renaissance man, an accomplished creative executive. He's worked in brand building, video game creation, design, marketing, storytelling, drawing, and most recently, a second career in music. He's earned awards for innovations in advertising during his years as a leader of the world-renowned ad agency Deutsche LA, and in his work overseeing development and marketing at video game giant Activision, maker of Call of Duty and Guitar Hero. These days, he's currently exploring his lifelong passion for music as a singer, songwriter, and multi-instrumentalist, with live performances and two recorded albums, 2021's Spare Room and his second album, Secondhand Smoke, which is coming out at the end of May. Just a shade older than the folks here at How to Tickle Yourself, he's 55. Hirschberg is also keenly focused on wellness and leading a fulfilling life with mindful practices, including daily meditation with his wife, surfing, focus techniques, and a diet without alcohol or sugar. I am today, this very day, just finishing a 10-day blood sugar reset with no gluten, no dairy, no sugar, and I am totally on board with that lifestyle as of now. I feel fucking great. You know, the older we get, the harder it is, except unless we make it easy on ourselves. And this is making it easy on me. So anyway, we have a lot to talk about. Welcome to the show, Eric. It's great to have you.
Duff, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
At the present moment, traveling town to town, the mystery of the motion, right here, right now. Right here, right now. Whoa, right here, right now.
So you're one of those guys who has a career. When I look at it, I'm like, I wish I had that career. It sounds pretty awesome. You want to give us a brief sketch?
As you were reading it, I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, oh, that guy sounds cool.
give us a sketch of how we got here today.
God, you know, I wish I had some master plan or strategy. It really was... I think that I've done a good job of responding to opportunities when they've presented themselves, and you know, sometimes maybe doing little things to help make those opportunities happen. But I had a very unusual path to becoming a CEO of a big company like Activision. I went to art school. I didn't go to business school. I was a creative kid. I had learning disabilities, dyslexia. I'm sure this diagnosis didn't exist when I was a kid, but I'm sure I would have been diagnosed with ADHD had that, you know, phrase existed at the time. And I wasn't a natural academic student, but I always was extremely creative. And I found my way to art school at UCLA. And I actually got in as a fine art major, quickly shifted to design, which made more sense for me. And that led to a career in advertising. And I only worked at two agencies. The one that I worked at right out of college, where I was an intern between my junior and senior year, which was a small agency here in LA focused on entertainment. And then I got lucky. Donnie Deutsch, who had started Deutsch New York, actually his father started Deutsch New York, but he had grown it into a kind of powerhouse. He looked at all the other agencies from New York that had come to LA and opened up a shop, and most of them had failed. And he said, well, what do they all have in common? They all sent out an executive from their New York office to open and run their LA office. And so he said, okay, I'm not going to do that. I want to meet people who are doing interesting things in LA, in the market. There seems to be something particular about the culture there that's different. And so I ended up on a list of people that he wanted to meet who was, you know, doing some interesting work. My partner and I were both at this small agency called Tall and Collins. And we both met Donnie, and he hired us to essentially open and build Deutsch LA, which became a powerhouse. And then at Deutsch LA, I was the chief creative officer, but my partner and I were also co-CEOs. So I sort of got my first taste of being a CEO through that business. And we grew that business from a handful of people to 500 people by the time I had left, I think just under 500. And I found that everything I needed to know about running a company with 3,500 employees like Activision, most of it I already knew in that, you know, journey from, you know, five employees to 500. I think the companies that I've run have had more in common, 500 employees to five employees, than 500 to thousands. I think they talk about 150 people, Dunbar's number, where you cease to be a sort of community where everyone knows each other's first names and, you know, everyone regularly interacts. And I think once you get above that number, you're essentially, you know, running a small country. So anyway, then I got lucky again. I was at a dinner party of a good friend of mine named Lawrence Bender, who you might know his name because he produced a lot of the best Quentin Tarantino movies. He's a great movie producer. Good Will Hunting. He's just a brilliant movie producer. And he had a dinner party, and I happened to be sitting next to a guy named Bobby Kotick, who was the chairman of Activision Blizzard. And at the time, my agency, Deutsch LA, was doing the Sony PlayStation advertising, and we did a very good job for them. And so he was obviously highly aware of that campaign and started picking my brain about it. And by the end of the dinner, he was trying to hire me to do the advertising for Activision, which I couldn't do because we had a conflict with Sony. But that led to a long, you know, a courtship and a friendship where over the next couple of years, he kept calling me and offering me different jobs, which I kept turning down. And then eventually he called and said, I finally figured out how I'm going to get you to come work for me. How? He says, you're going to come be the CEO of Activision. And I said, okay, now I'm listening. And, you know, I said at the time, I go, look, don't do anything stupid, man. I know I've got the title CEO on my business card currently, but I'm the CEO of an ad agency, which has more in common with being the RA of a dorm floor than, you know, running a, you know, being an officer of a public company like yours. So, but he said something that resonated with me, which is he said, that the company was a creative company and that what I didn't know how to do, I could learn and he could surround me with, but what that I did know how to do was what he thought the company really needed at that point. So I was enticed and I took that leap.
And you were there until when?
I think it was March of 2018.
Okay.
I stayed on as a consultant for a year after that. And then I came back as a consultant and helped out last year as well. So I've been there when they've needed me, but I stepped down as CEO March 2018.
One of the things your crack PR team sent me originally was a commencement speech that you gave in 2015 at UCLA School of Arts and Architecture. And I wanted to, I have three quotes from your speech. It's a great speech. And I've got a couple I want to ask you about.
Okay.
I just want you to define it or say what it meant or what have you. The first one was the story about the university of my eyeballs, which is one of the great stories. Tell that to our listeners.
So, as I just said, I was a CEO of a company that I didn't totally feel qualified for, I guess. I you know, came from a creative services industry, professional services, and this was a, you know, video games are complex technology. They're complex software. Yeah. They're also entertainment. They're also art, but there's a lot of technology. And then also it's a publicly traded company, and I was an officer and, you know, one of the people who had to speak on earnings calls to, you know, Wall Street analysts. And I felt kind of in over my head on a lot of that, but learned and grew and, you know, took this opportunity to really expand my skills. But when I got there, I encountered a few things that were ways that the company made, you know, did business that were kind of ingrained deeply into the culture. And there was this thing called the take rate. I'd never heard that phrase before, but it kept coming up in every meeting. In my first few weeks, every time I'd sit in a meeting, people would say, what was the take rate on this game? And they'd always talk about it in kind of hushed tones. Oh, it was 28, you know, and that would be bad. And then they'd say, oh, 35. And go, oh, okay, good. You know, we like it. And so I didn't know what it was, but I ascertained quickly that it figured prominently into how this company made big decisions. And it turns out that it was a research strategy that they've been using for a while, where they literally, you know, kind of exposed focus groups to ideas for video games. And it was the number of people that would say they'd take it, like they'd buy it. And I was immediately skeptical of this strategy, but then I said, okay, but what's the stimulus? These games don't exist yet. What are we showing them? Oh, we'll have the research people come to your office and take you through it. They were literally reading a paragraph of the English language to describe a video game to people and then asking if they would buy that video game. And I'm not anti-consumer research. I'm not anti-gathering data, but I don't love, I am against bad stimulus. So anyway, we had this green light meeting for a game called Skylanders. And I had sort of done away with the take rate. And I said, okay, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to get consumer input in different ways, but we're going to improve the stimulus so that they're actually responding to something that, you know, is more akin to what the final experience is going to be. And Skylanders is a kid's game. There was a lot of skepticism about it because kids games were going kind of downhill in sales, and the Nintendo platform, the Wii U, wasn't as good as the Wii. And so that install base was gone, and there weren't as many kids on Xbox and PlayStation. Anyway, there was a lot of skepticism, and it was sort of on the slate to be killed. And I saw this game. I don't know if you have any kids in the age group, but it kind of took over the world. It was a game where real life toys came to life. You'd take a real action figure, put it on a portal, and that character would come to life in the game.
Oh, wow.
And that was magic, you know, just like every kid's dream. You know, we imagine our toys as being alive and right. Have, you know, relationships with them. So it just kind of made that fantasy a little more real. And I just believed in the magic of it. And so I said, no, we're going to make this game. And so I was in this first big financial review, and, you know, every big decision maker was there. And it came to that game, and there was a lot of skepticism and a lot of, you know, questions. And someone asked, well, what was the take rate on this game? And my whole team, like every head kind of turns to look at me like, you're on, dude, you killed it, you know? And so I said, we didn't do that research this time. And they said, oh, what research did we do? And I said, well, we did a study at the University of my eyeballs, and the results were compelling. And everyone laughed, thankfully. But more importantly, everyone accepted the answer. And I think what I was doing was actually putting my neck in the guillotine. I think I was actually saying, if it fails, it's on me. And I was probably putting my job on the line. I probably didn't know I was doing that at the time. I'd like to think I still would have done it if I had known, but that was, you know, I was new, and I was saying, we're going to take this risk. And, you know, that's why. And then it went on and broke all these records and, you know, became a $1 billion franchise and did wonderfully. So what I loved about what happened in the aftermath of that is that the University of my eyeballs sort of caught on, that phrase sort of caught on culturally. And for a while, people might have depersonalized. They'd say, oh, this is one of those, you know, University of Eric's eyeballs things. But eventually it became like a University of my eyeballs. I think it's, you know, like this is a way to make decisions. And to me, the wisdom that undergirds that is that you can't always research your way to knowing what to do. The data will only take us so far. And if something doesn't exist yet, you have to take a risk, and someone has to believe it and pound the table and say, I believe in this idea. And there's risk involved in that. And it's scary, but that's the only way great things happen.
You're speaking my language there. All right. Number two, don't go out there and avoid blame for a living. That's a great piece of advice, but give the context of that one.
Oh, I think the story I just told probably is relates to it. You know, I think that particularly in corporate America, there is a career path that just involves never having your name on a loser, you know, never having your name on something that didn't go right. And people develop all these language strategies to become Neo in the Matrix, to just kind of always be able to dodge the bullets and, you know, never kind of commit until it's, you know, out in the marketplace and proving that it's successful. And I'd never encountered that before. I think, you know, different industries are good at different things. Ad agencies, and I think probably creative, probably professional services overall. I'd imagine this is true of architecture, law firms. You're being hired for your expertise. You have to commit. You have to put your name on things. You have to say, we believe this is the way it should go. Mm-hmm. And then you get judged by that result. I think creative people in general spend their whole lives doing that. The first time you hold up a drawing and say, Mom, yeah, I made this, you know, you're putting yourself out there to be judged. And so I was very comfortable with that. And I'd never encountered that, you know, that sort of mode before. And I think it's, you know, it's not the most fulfilling way to manage your life or your career to make a living. It's more right. fun to hone your gut. It's not all gut. You have to inform your gut. You have to ask a lot of questions, look at what data is available, you know, research the shit out of everything. And then at the end of the day, you got to make a decision. You got to make the call. And then I think those are the more fulfilling ways to make careers.
Agreed.
Even when there's failure.
Agreed.
Because you learn the most from those.
All right. And the last one is, and then we can move on here. Don't put limits on yourself. Sounds self-evident, but what do you actually mean by that?
Well, the context is important. I was speaking to my alma mater, which is the School of Arts and Architecture. So I was speaking to a bunch of creatives. And the real thrust of that speech was I looked it up at the time. And, you know, at the time I looked at how many CEOs are there running a company of this scale with an art degree. And I was the only one that I could find. I found more Fortune 500 company CEOs with no degree than an art degree. So it just jumped out at me that why should that be? And why is that? And half of it, I think, is biases and limitations that corporate America in particular probably puts on creative people in positions of leadership. Because like any, you know, boards of directors and shareholders, they want predictability, they want structure, they want wherever possible things to be very predictable and mechanized. Those are not the words that leap to mind when we describe the creative process, which is right. fairly chaotic and unpredictable. Right. So part of it's legitimate, and creative people shouldn't be running every company, but they shouldn't be running no companies.
Right.
And so the other half, I think, is limits that creatives put on themselves. And that's what I was sort of putting at the kids' feet, saying, look, you're going to go out there and it's very seductive. They're going to call you the creatives. They're going to call you the talent. They're going to call you the developers. And then they're going to give you a special playpen to go to work in. There's going to be beanbags in there and there's going to be M&Ms in there. And you get to wear your flip-flops to work in there. And don't take that bait, because all the really important decisions about, you know, how the business is going to run are happening outside of the treehouse at a conference table that you're not sitting at. And usually no creative people are sitting at. And so learn the language of whatever business you're in, whether that's fine art, learn the gallery business. If it's, you know, theater, learn the theater business. If it's advertising, learn the business side. If it's video games, movies, learn what matters to the people who are holding the purse strings and holding those strategic decision-making strings so that you can make your case from an informed position. Because if you just make your case from a position of passion, it's the easiest thing to dismiss.
I mean, I know you have a music career that we're going to get to in a sec here, but if that doesn't work out, you should get on the commencement speech circuit and just start giving this one all around.
Thank you. Is there a circuit? That sounds fun. I liked doing that. I thought that was a fun thing to get asked to do. Brian Chesky, who I know and admire very much, is the CEO of Airbnb. And Airbnb wasn't a public company at that time. Now there would be two.
So he's an art degree. Yeah. Wow. He went to
Rhode Island School of Design. And I feel like you can feel it in that product. You know, I think both he and his partners that, that founded the company were designers. And, you know, you can feel the sort of high touch care and attention to consumer experience in everything that company does. And that's where I feel like creative people are unfortunately overlooked. I feel like that's often the difference maker. Often a company can't make it just on a manufacturing advantage or a technological advantage. Sometimes it really is just out executing everyone else and delivering the most special, sublime human experience through your products. And where that's the case, I think more companies should choose more creative people and then do what Bobby and Activision did with me. Teach them the things they don't know. You got to learn how to read a spreadsheet. You got to learn how to sit with finance people. You got to learn the technology. It's hard. It's scary. But everyone has to do that. If you were a finance person, you then have to learn how to talk about creativity, you know, and that's right. Probably uncomfortable for them too. So everyone has to get outside their comfort zone to lead generally, eventually, and creative people should be asked to do that more and they should strive to do that more.
Yeah, it's scary, but empowering ultimately, right? Yeah. All right, I got a question about dyslexia. My editor at Harper had a friend who had dyslexia and he told her that he had all these great life hacks that he had to work into sort of getting around it that actually made him more effective at certain tasks than your neurotypical people. And she actually asked me, I looked into, before my last book, I spent like 6 months looking into a book on dyslexia. And we ultimately backed away from it because I was like, you know what, as someone, this area is so fraught with emotion.
Yeah.
That as someone who has no horse in this race, whether my own or a family member or anything else, I was like, I don't want to wade into
this. Are you the right person to tell that story?
Yeah. I was like, yeah. I was like, it's so interesting. I had never gotten as deep into the different ways that we grasp the world around us.
Yeah.
So I know that you call dyslexia your superpower. Does that life hack thing totally resonate with you?
That totally resonates with me. And I actually wrote a song about this. It's on my last album, Spare Room, and it's called What You Get. And there is a, well, first to answer your question, and then I'll segue it to that piece of music. So first of all, I've spoken to kids who struggle with learning disabilities. And the first thing I say is, well, first of all, we didn't have such inclusive language when I was a kid. So they called it learning disabilities.
Right.
You know, it wasn't neurodivergent or learning differences. It was learning disabilities. I actually think that's a more accurate description. But it's not a learning disability. It's a teaching disability. And what it's just a different way of learning. And I'm not saying like it'd be so easy to solve this, and I'm not putting too much at the educational, you know, systems feet, because that system is doing what all systems do, which is that they're aiming for the thing that works for the most people in it. But dyslexic people read more slowly. In my case, that led to much greater than average comprehension and retention. And I had almost, I don't want to throw around terms like photographic memory that have like a technical definition. I don't know if it meets that, but I had a scary good ability to remember quotes and things that I had read, because dyslexic people read one word at a time. They don't take in the whole sentence, and sometimes they invert words, and you know, those are things that cause you to have to read things multiple times, to read it more slowly, to make notes, to use pencil, to underline. All those things turned out to be really good for me in the long run. I still read much more slowly than most people. You know, I read a thing that Amazon starts every meeting. No one gets the deck before the meeting. They all sit down and they spend the first few minutes of every meeting reading the materials in real time, and then they discuss them. They don't do pre-reads. And I'm like, that wouldn't work for me. I'd have to show up 10 minutes early to the meeting to, you know, get a head start on everybody. But so yeah, there are things for me, the seminal moment was in second grade. You know, we had a reading test. To figure out which reading group you were going to get put into. And they didn't call it group one, two, three, four, five. It was like blue, green, yellow, you know, but everyone could tell like the smart kids were in the blue group and the less smart kids were in the red group. And I tested into the blue group based on the test results. But then the first day we had to go around a circle and read aloud. And after that, I got put in the red group, not one group down, all like from the top slot to the bottom,
wow,
like, all the way down. Because I guess I jumbled every word and read slow, and I was like, okay, this isn't going to work. So yeah, I do think ultimately, the reason I think it's a superpower though, is that at least in creative fields, we spend a lot of our adult life trying to figure out a unique way to look at things.
Right.
A different angle, a different point of view. And when you learn differently, you're more likely to have those unique angled observations, I've found. I'm also colorblind. And as in advertising at various times, I had the title art director and copywriter over my career. So an art director and a copywriter is both dyslexic and colorblind, which is a good segue. The song that I wrote, What You Get, the bridge of that song has a lyric that says, colorblind, dyslexic, scatterbrained, and misdirected. Read so slow, I got demoted. Strong comprehension duly noted, though. I knew the answers, but I couldn't prove them before the deadlines, and they wouldn't move them. They tried to give me Ritalin. So what if I'm a little insecure right now? Because when I get older, that chip's not going to be on my shoulder. It's going to be on my mind, and you'll find me working harder than everyone else. Until the last one left, I have to convince is myself. And to me, that's about the ultimate thing that it does, is it gave me that chip on my shoulder. It gave me that thing to go prove that I could do it and that I was going to, whatever I lacked in natural ability in this particular area, I was going to make up for with extra effort. And to me, if that's, you know, one of the outcomes of a disability, then it's a gift.
And you'll take it. All right, let's talk about your mindfulness practice and meditation and also your diet. We talk a lot about that stuff on this show. There's a lot of echoes to what we aspire to here. When did this start? What's it do for you? How do you cultivate it?
It depends on which part. I don't know the exact date I stopped drinking. My wife and I have tried to piece this together. I think it's been about 8 years. It might be longer though. And I didn't stop drinking. Like, you know, I didn't like never have a drink again. Like I've broken, you know, I've had a glass of wine here and there. It started with a dry January like thing. I don't know if dry January existed then, but I just decided let's take a month off and see how that feels. And I didn't miss it. And then I said, okay, I'm just going to have a drink when we're out to a nice dinner, like maybe at a nice restaurant, I'll have a glass of wine. And then I'd do that. And then I'd go to bed with a headache and I'd wake up with, you know, deeper bags under my eyes and I'd hit the snooze alarm. I'd miss the gym the next morning. And I'd realize that my body just didn't like it. And you know, I didn't like it enough to have it be worth that. So that's when I kind of just cut it out. And I found that, you know, everything's improved. You know, I sleep better. Mm-hmm. I you know, work out better. I am more attentive. And, you know, there are, if you have a healthy relationship with alcohol, no problem. You know, a lot of people do. And I didn't have an unhealthy relationship. I didn't have a drinking problem, but it wasn't helping my life. It was, you know, it definitely wasn't a net positive. So, that one has been, the interesting thing is the name of the song comes from an interesting,
name of the song is I Love Not Drinking.
Yeah. Right? I wrote a new song album. Called it. Yeah. Thank you. Shouldn't take that for granted. The name of the song I Love Not Drinking came from a conversational necessity, which is alcohol is unique. It's the only thing that you have to explain why you're not having it.
Oh, and yeah.
Mm-hmm. No one ever says, like, really, you don't like mayonnaise on your sandwich. Why? You know, do you have a mayonnaise addiction? you know, it's unique. I'm cribbing from Jim Gaffigan just before the internet finds that joke. That's a Jim Gaffigan joke. So that was, but it's such a true observation. And I found that whenever I would not drinking, if I was with a group of people who were drinking, they didn't like it. Sometimes they apply a little bit of pressure if they're having a toast, if they're having a, everyone's doing a shot. And I get it. You know, you kind of want everyone to, you know, get stupid together and, you know, and no one wants to feel self-conscious. So they go like, come on, Hirschberg, you got to have one drink. And I never had a really good answer because, you know, look, if your answer is, look, I'm in the program, I'm recovering, everyone backs off immediately, hopefully. but if your answer is anything other than that, which it was for me,
right,
then they apply a little pressure and they think, no, just this once, come on, we're celebrating. And so whenever I would use things like I quit drinking, I stop drinking, I don't drink, people would continue to pressure. When I found the phrase, because I love not drinking, it stopped everyone in their tracks.
Why don't you drink?
Why aren't you drinking? Because I love not drinking. And people go, oh, okay, I guess I can't, I don't have anything to say about that, you know, because it's a positive, affirmative choice. And then that gives people the information they need to know. And so to me, that was, I love that phrase. It always kind of made people smile. It had a lot of social utility. And I thought, boy, there's a lot of power in language, and all of our language around not drinking is negative. The word quit drinking is negative. Gave up, that's a negative phrase. I gave up drinking. These are all super negative words versus how I feel. Just, I love my life a lot more without alcohol. So I just wanted to,
you know, that's great. So you wrote a song about it.
And also the song is written like a barroom sing-along. You know, it sounds because it's because I don't want drinkers to be the only ones who get to celebrate and have fun. And
yeah,
you know,
I think Lucas Nelson has a song on his new album called "Can I Get an Alcohallelujah?" and it's basically a like a sing along too.
But that sounds like a different, more, you know, in the opposite direction. I love Lucas, by the way.
Okay, so meditation. Tell me about your meditation practice.
So it started as a way to counter the stresses of a big corporate job. You know, as you would expect, those jobs come with a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety, a lot of also travel and other things that throw sleep off and, you know, create a sort of, you know, they disrupt all your healthy patterns, whether that's sleeping and working out because you change time zones and you're, you know, in a hotel bed instead of your bed. And then also a little bit of social dislocation, away from family, away from your friends. And, you know, just the stresses overall. And I just needed ways to manage it. And so I went on a journey of trying to find those things. And to me, exercise and meditation have been the two most powerful. And I have used all the apps. I've read a lot of books. I love Sam Harris's app in particular, the Waking Up app. If you're interested in this, I feel like it's a great kind of half meditation guidance, half TED talk. You know, you're learning a lot about philosophy. He's a philosopher and a neuroscientist as well as a meditation expert. There's another one called 10% Happier that curates a whole bunch of different meditation gurus or leaders. And you can sort of dabble and find different personalities or different people who you respond to. But eventually I didn't need the apps. I don't always use the apps. Sometimes I just do it on my own. And for me, it's just, it's sometimes that 20 minutes is the only 20 minutes of any given day when you're just focused on yourself and your mindset. Every other minute can be filled where you are doing something, where you're doing a task, you're doing an errand, you are doing work. Even when you're having fun, there's an activity attached to it. And I think sitting with no activity and no focus other than your breath and your balance and, you know, just getting in tune with yourself, particularly in a world with, you know, a lot of distractions and a lot of, you know, business models who need our attention constantly. Right. It's a really good thing. It's been really powerful for me. A good thing to do.
That's interesting. I wonder, you know, you're talking about being the one art school CEO. It'd be interesting to find out how many Fortune 500 CEOs meditate.
I bet a lot. It's a very useful tool.
So let's get to music. So, your first album was 2021. You got another one coming out now. Is this how do you characterize this? It's more than a hobby.
Yeah.
Right. So what is music to you?
My life's passion. My greatest passion. It's always been more than a hobby. When I had other, you know, careers, particularly high profile things that I was doing, it was hard to maybe convince people of that. But I've always done it with a lot of intention and a lot of time and a lot of care and at a pretty high velocity. You know, the number of songs I would write per year, I know a couple of people who are much, you know, are professional singer-songwriters who much higher profile careers than I do. And yeah, I'm about on par from an output standpoint from most, you know, professionals I know. And I have been for a long time. So it's always been in the background. And I don't know how to answer your question, but I get it a lot. And I feel like society has this tendency to want to categorize each
right.
other. Yeah. We want to be able to say
is
that
it
person
your new job?
Is,
yeah.
Yeah. The honest answer is, I don't know. I just know that I can't not do it. And I was, and also there was this question, this might have all been in my head, everything I'm about to say. As I became more and more public as a business person, I became more and more private as an artist. And like I said, maybe this is all in my head. Mark Twain, I think it's Mark Twain, has that great quote that says, you wouldn't care so much about what other people think of you if you knew how infrequently they did. So maybe this is one of those things where it was all in my head that I thought, okay, people wouldn't like this weird adjacency of he's running a big division of Activision Blizzard, but he's also an artist and a songwriter. And my songs are very personal and they're very revealing. To do a good job in my genre, you have to be very open. I just wasn't comfortable.
Yeah. So a good example of that is because of high profiles, the people want to take pot shots. James Dolan.
Yeah.
I don't know what his music is, but anything I've ever read about his band has been derogatory just because people want to make fun of him.
I don't know his music either, but I've heard the same stories.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there was part of me that just didn't want to, you know, I just felt too vulnerable. And also I felt like, you know, those are big jobs. You got a lot of people counting on you. You got, you know, employees counting on you. You got investors counting on you. You know, I think everyone has a right to say, we want the CEO's eye on the ball.
Right.
And that felt fair to me. But eventually it became like a secret life. I don't know what to compare it to other than like a mistress. I remember very vividly, like, you know, you read about like people have like a fucking second family somewhere. Felt like that, where I had a friend over who, this is a person who I consider myself close to. And maybe I've been friends with them for like 10 years. And there was a cocktail party at our house and he saw a guitar in the corner. And he says, but this is the person who I met through professional life, but you know, a real friend. He goes, who plays guitar in the family? And I was like, wow, this is, it's like, this is the other half of my body. This is such a big deal to me. This figures so prominently into my perception of who I am. And here's this person who I consider myself close to, who I'm open with, who I have trust with, doesn't even know this side of me. So I could feel that there was a bit of a deathbed regret in the making, brewing. I could feel that if I just left this completely private and secret and unattended and kept playing it for the same handful of friends and family until I died, that I would regret it. And that, you know, I think all art, it's the tree falling in the forest. You got to find an audience. You got to put it out there. Otherwise it is a hobby. And so I felt like I was ready to do that. And I really wanted to.
So, I have listened to the, album and, really enjoyed it. It's,
thank you.
I was trying to figure out words to describe it that, you know, weren't sort of musical geeky, because I don't even have that vocabulary. It's very calming and it has a sweetness to it.
I like those words.
I think my favorite lyric of all of it is in The Most Beautiful Boy, which is a beautiful song.
Thank you.
I must be lucky because I'm not this good.
Yeah. I don't know many parents who haven't held their baby in their arms and not felt that.
Right.
Yeah.
Your song on It's Hard to Be Human has an interesting story. I want to ask you about that. And then I have a question about the song. Tell us the story about It's Hard to Be Human.
So It's Hard to Be a Human Being. I was very lucky to be very close personal friends with Norman Lear. I'm assuming most of your viewers know who Norman Lear is, but if you don't, he was a legendary television producer who really changed culture through situation comedies, of all things, where he really put things like race and racism and single motherhood and, feminism and discrimination and all kinds of different topics into these comedies, and really got America talking about them and change culture through his, you know, through his work.
But for the listeners who don't know him, we're talking about All in the Family, Sanford and Son,
Jefferson's,
One Day at a Time, Jefferson's, a legend.
And then he lived to 102. He became a kind of national treasure figure. He was very politically active. He was an activist. He started People for the American Way. Just a remarkable man. And we were buddies. Like, everyone who knows of this friendship in my life assumes there is sort of a Mr. Miyagi, Daniel-san type of, you know, equation to the relationship. And it really wasn't that. He was just a pal. And we hit it off when we met, and we became very close friends. And he is known for his, you know, he has a wide battery of aphorisms and quotable, pithy pieces of language. And it's hard to be a human being is one of them that I've heard him say more than once. And the first time he said it to me, I was at his house, and I was complaining about something. I can't even remember what it was that I was upset about, but I think I was asking for his advice or if he'd ever been through anything similarly. And he listened very intently, and he seemed like he was about to tell me how to solve the problem. And he just goes, "You know, Eric, it's hard to be a human being." And I thought, God damn it. No answers here except the big answer, which is that it's not supposed to be easy. And that sounds hard, and you'll figure it out. And I, in a weird way, I found it very freeing, which there's a lyric in the song that says that.
So here's my question. Yeah. The lesson in it, I think, it's hard to be a human being, if properly processed, makes it easy to be a human being.
I think that's fair, because I think that we waste a lot of energy trying to make it easy.
Right.
We waste a lot of energy trying to avoid discomfort and avoid conflict and avoid adversity and avoid mistakes. And all those things are part of the journey. They're all part of being human. And once you accept that, you stop wasting that energy. It's still mm-hmm. hard.
Right.
But you go through it in a way where you're trying to do the hard things well, and you're trying to do the hard things right, as opposed to trying to avoid the hard mm-hmm. things. And to me, that was the mindset, you know, kind of chiropractic shift that made. And so it always inspired me. I was lucky that I wrote the song a few years before he died. And it touched him enough where during COVID, he was together with his family over the holiday. And he asked me if I would play it for him and his assembled family. And so I did a little video in this room. And before it was even out, you know, they got a preview performance of it. And it was just wonderful. He was honored that I was inspired enough to write it. And I was honored that, you know, to know him and to have plucked that piece of wisdom out of our many conversations.
So do you have a plan to do any touring, or do you just play locally?
No, I am trying to figure that out now. It's a hard equation. There's a chicken egg thing, you know, as you're building an audience. I don't have any announcements today, but this is something I'm actively working on. And I just did a show here in LA at the Village that was, you know, sort of a showcase and played through the whole album, and it went well, and got a great band, and something I'm working on right now.
Awesome. Okay. So I want to read something to you.
Okay.
Because I was reading this last week. It's a somewhat long paragraph, but it sounded to me that it might resonate with you. It's from a book about the Indian Upanishads. There's one called the Katha Upanishad. And this is just from a Swami who was writing about it. And he said, when man achieves some sort of order and stability in his outer life, and if his mind is not stifled in the process, but continues to be creative and seeking, he is bound to feel the impact of a vaster and more significant inner world pressing upon his mind and seeking his attention. It is only then that he becomes aware of something profound and deep within himself, close to him and not far away. This recognition at once makes for a gradual silencing of the clamors of the sense organs. A mood of inwardness and peace descends on the soul of man, and he now enters on the search for the truth of experience, not in the field of sense data, but beyond them. This stage is characterized by a certain maturity of outlook, a chastening of the emotions, and a mood of comparative unconcern with the pressures of the external world. Mm. His pursuit of truth, which was till then intellectual and academic, now becomes a converging life endeavor.
That's wonderful. Who wrote that?
It's a guy named Swami Raghunathananda. It's called The Message of the Upanishads. I'll send you a picture of it.
And
but
by
it
the
made
way,
me think of you.
Kudos to you for the pronunciation. You just aced two difficult ones right there. You just kind of sailed past them. That was impressive. I love that. And I wish I had read that a few years ago.
Same.
Yeah. Yeah.
But here we are. There's only now.
I did read a book by David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, mm-hmm. and I don't know what to call him, a public intellectual, I guess, called Second Mountain.
Mm.
And in, you know, much more Western language and prose, he had a similar message. That was a useful read. And I think a lot of meditation, a lot of the philosophy that undergirds meditation has that insight baked into it.
Totally.
But I also find there's an empathy in that I really like, which is that it's a life stage,
right?
That there's an appropriate timing to this. And I think a lot of people kick themselves that they're not able to achieve this state of mind when they're in a younger stage or when they're, and man, I could never have even had the bandwidth to pay attention to these types of thoughts when I was in my 20s or my 30s.
Totally.
And not just because you're busy, but also because you're at that stage where you're proving things to yourself and you're proving things to the world and you're competing and you're building stature and you're building, you know, hopefully some security and stability in your life. And those things are all encompassing, and that's okay. I have a thing about work-life balance, which is a big topic. I found it's gotten a bigger topic generationally, that this is something that is very important to people. And I always say you should strive to have work-life balance by the end of your life. There's never been a single day when I feel like I've had it that day. Like, that feels unrealistic to me. If you have ambitiousness, maybe it's realistic, but not, it's a very difficult bedfellow with excellence and with, detail and, all of those other things, competition.
All right. Well, that brings me to our last question, which is about what your motto, which you have on a necklace. Are you wearing that necklace? There it is. Okay. So it's care the most.
Care the most.
Tell me, other than the obvious, what does that mean?
So first of all, the necklace was designed by my wife, Tara, who is a jewelry designer amongst other things. And, she made me she has this line that she calls dogma tags. So they're designed after the military dog tags.
Oh, nice.
But it has your dogma. This is definitely mine. The origin story of this phrase is kind of interesting. When I was leaving Deutsch, LA, I was a founder-like figure at that office. And, there was a lot of what's the future going to hold? And, I had been there for 14 years and, for the whole arc from 5 employees to hundreds of employees. And they were sending me off with well wishes and with, pranks and, toasts and roasts and the whole bit. And it just didn't feel right for me to just receive gifts because that company and that group of people had given me so much too. So I wanted to leave them with something. So I gave myself the assignment, sort of an advertising assignment. The brief was, what is the thing that needs to continue after I'm gone that will most ensure future success? That was the assignment I gave myself. And I thought about it and I wrote that phrase, care the most. And I gave a speech and said, this is what we got right while I was here. This is how we won. There are multiple ways to achieve anything, but this was ours so far. And if you continue to care the most, to just out care the competition, whenever you're doing anything creative, I think that's a huge difference maker because everyone's above the minimum required threshold of talent at a certain level. Everyone's good enough to do something great. The question is, are you going to sweat the details and put in the effort that it takes to actually achieve something great with that capability? And so I made a piece of art. It was a silk screen. I can send you a picture of it. A giant silk screen. I found the studio in town that does Shepherd Fairey's silk screen. So they had the largest silk screen in LA. And I dragged it twice. And it says care the most with the corporate colors of Deutsche LA, which was orange. And I said, I made two of these and then I destroyed the screen. And one of them I'm going to leave here. You can hang it in the lobby. You can put it in the storeroom, whatever you choose. I'm going to take the other one with me. It's going to hang behind my desk at Activision. And it now hangs right outside my music studio here. So it's kind of followed me wherever I go. And it is hanging in the lobby of Deutsche LA still to this day. And it's now become a core value of mine. It's become a core value of three different companies that I've been involved with. Deutsche LA, Activision, and a company I advise called Beta Technologies, who also has embraced it. And so it's just this great mantra for makers. It's just, I think it's a great mantra for anyone who's trying to create something special for a living as a way to win. And the other thing is, it's also competitive. You know, care is a wonderful soft word. And the most is a wonderful hard word, you know?
It's like being the best at loving other people.
Yeah. And that's what you're doing when you're creating things for a living.
All right, Eric, this was awesome. Thank you for joining us. Listeners, Secondhand Smoke coming out end of May, but you can also check out a handful of the songs that have already been released on Spotify. On Eric. It's Eric Hirschberg, HIRSHBERG and ERIC, Eric Hirschberg. Check him out, have a listen, and you know, hopefully we'll meet in person someday. This is a great conversation. Really appreciate it.
I enjoyed it, Duff. Thank you.
All right, man. Cheers. Welcome back to the show, Joey of Rockledge. Where have you been?
Thank you. I've been really busy. I had a little face cancer removed and nothing harmful. Everything's fine.
She is such a great podcast host that she decided to sit out the first half of this interview so Eric Hirschberg wouldn't be distracted by the thing on her face. That's how much she's dedicated to the cause. Anyway, right. Welcome back.
But I did listen to the entire thing, and he's wonderful. What a great soul. What a sweetheart. The whole time I was thinking like how much I want my sister to hear the interview and her family. They all have learning. They have a teaching disability is what they grew up with. So I'm really excited for my sister to hear the interview today.
And compare myself to him in any way, like obviously a really interesting and accomplished career, but the whole time I had this feeling that he is something close to what I would be if I'd gotten my shit together earlier in life and really gone for the brass ring. And I love the fact that he has segued from two very interesting high pressure corporate jobs into following his passion. This is the thesis and motto and strategy and aspiration of how to tickle yourself is to follow your tickles, right? And to be able to step away from that kind of lucrative employment, but also credentialed stuff. And you know, there are all sorts of perks from running big companies in addition to the stress, and kudos to him for following his dream.
Yeah. I loved what he said about not limiting yourself, right? In that he actually used what was once considered a disability, actually used it to his advantage to motivate himself. I think that's amazing. So good.
All right. So I've got one more for you here, Joey. This is true to form. And it's also very apropos because Eric Hirschberg, as everyone knows, is a creative. He's worked in creative industries. So I was reading a book. I mentioned this guy, Swami Raghunathananda, in there. That's the passage I read for about the Katha Upanishad. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about the different planes of existence. And he was saying, you know, the Indians, the Hindus, and talk about reincarnation, that if you stay in bondage, you come back, you're come back and born again to try to still work out, work things out for your soul. And they said that, or he said, repeated embodiments in created worlds is rated low in Vedanta because it is bondage, involving as it does reduction again and again to the status of a creature. Creation, creature.
Oh, that one's good.
Right?
Yes. Nice and, work.
And you don't want to be a creature because you have no freedom of choice. You've been created. You want to be your own creation, right? So you don't want to be a creature of someone else's right. creation. Mm-hmm. But I never put together creature and creation. So that
no, I didn't either.
If Matt McButter ever listened to these, there's no evidence that he does because he's never told us, said anything about any of them since he
moved on to
other things. He would like that one. He would give me five stars.
I think he'd give it a stamp of approval.
I got one more for you before we close out here. Right. I read a great thing. It's a little rhyme from the same book from Sanskrit, and it's just a three-word thing, and it's a great conception. It's Satyam, Shivam, and Sundaram, the true, the good, and the beautiful.
Wow.
Satyam, Shivam, Sundaram.
Yes.
So if you're in the market for triples, if you want to hit, go for a triple, those are the ones you want. True, good, and beautiful. So to close That's us out, truth. To close us out, I'm gonna do another Raghunathananda, and this one's a little deep in the Vedanta philosophy. But basically, the point he's making is that, so the Vedantists say that, you and God, you are the universe. God is within you. God is without you. God is everything. It's all one thing. So if it's all one thing, then you are any other word you want to throw out there, right? You could say you are God, you are the universe, you're everything. And the point he's making is that this idea, which is a little hard to wrap your head around, once embraced and grasp kind of solves a bunch of things. And their words for the everything is Brahman and the universe within you is Atman, but Brahman is Atman. So he says the following: if Brahman and Atman are one, if the world is spiritual through and through, then certain consequences follow for the life and destiny of man. It at once unifies the external and internal, the secular and the spiritual fields of man's life. It unifies science and religion. The discords and conflicts arising from partial views of reality become resolved in the light of this total view, making possible a comprehensive spirituality in which the believer and the non-believer, the theist and the agnostic, the religious man and the scientist, the contemplative and the worker become transformed into fellow seekers of truth.
Wow. So the world just needs a little Raghunathananda. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Right. Thank you for listening, folks. Sorry, it's been a while. We'll be back soon.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to How to Tickle Yourself with your host, Duff McDonald, and me, Joey of Rockledge. You can help us by liking, subscribing, and sharing this podcast with others. You can talk to us and see what else is happening on Instagram and Facebook at How to Tickle Yourself. This program was recorded in Studio B of the historic Rockledge Recording Studio. Right Here, Right Now, our original 16-part theme music, was written and recorded by the legendary Paul Reddick and Kyle Ferguson of the Sidemen, with Steve Mariner on bass and drums and in the mixing room. This podcast is produced and distributed by Storic Media. Our editor is Oscar Desiderio. Our producers are Kristen Verbitsky and Chuck Labella. For more information, visit storicmedia.com. That's storicmedia.com.